Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Anne Brashares, who reads from and discusses her new book, Three Willows, The Sisterhood Grows, published by Delacorte. In the weeks to come, we have Muhammad Yunus, David and Nick Sheff, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. Thank you for supporting your independent bookstore. I've just been told before we start that on February 1st, Three Willows will be number one on the New York Times bestseller list. So, yay! Many of us were introduced to the sisterhood of the traveling pants through our daughters and our granddaughters. We came to know Lena, Tibby, Bridget, and Carmen, and the miraculous pair of pants that were accompanied by a set of rules. In Three Willows, it is a new summer and a new sisterhood, with Patty, Joe, and Amma. Is that how you say her name? Please join me in welcoming the author of Three Willows, Anne Brashares.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. I love this bookstore. And I think the first stop I remember making on my first book tour was at the Tattered Cover. I think it was the one in Denver. It was the second book of the Traveling Pants series, and it was kind of a mother-daughter themed book. And so it was the mother-daughter tour. I brought my mother and my daughter. My daughter, I think, was two at the time. This actually was not my first ever bookstore appearance. I remember very shortly after my first book, which was The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, came out, my mom, the book had not become a success yet. It was very small. And she basically forced our local bookstore to have me. And so she sort of bulldozed them into having me. And I remember I went there, and I was so sick. I had all of my three children who were all littler at the time, and I had a fever of like 103, and I couldn't talk. I remember my face was just burning, and so my mother did my reading for me. That was my first great experience. And in the audience were a few of my family friends, two of my friends from school, and my dad. And when the question and answer time came, I looked at it and I said, does anyone have any questions? And there was nobody. Finally, my dad raised his hand. And then the whole party went back to my mom's house, and she made about 17 dozen cookies in the shape of pants. So you can see my great successes on the road here. I wanted to tell you this little event from a couple of nights ago, which was that I was at my in-law's house in New York City where we live, and it was my father-in-law's birthday party, and we had a party, and you know, everybody was eating a lot and eating a lot of cake, and everybody was tired and full, and my three children disappeared, and I wasn't sure what happened to them, but we needed to go home, so I went and looked for them, and I found them in the bedroom of my parents-in-law, the three of them lined up on the bed with their chins in their hands, and they were watching something on TV, and they were very involved. And I said, well, what are you guys watching? And they said, we're watching your movie, which I guess was on TV. I guess it's on occasionally on TV. And it was cute. And my daughter, who's seven, is sort of just getting the idea of all this stuff. And afterward, I was putting her to bed, and she said, Mommy, I'm very proud of you that you have your ideas in the world, which I thought was a very nice thing to say. And I've just been thinking about what an honor that is, in a way, to have some ideas that made their way into the world. We all, I think, have our ideas in the world in all kinds of ways, through people we love and talk to and our opinions. But, you know, to see some of them in a movie, to see them in books, to get to continue to try and write them and to relate my experiences to other people, my kind of internal life, to kind of share with other people's, my brain to yours, which is an honor and really, really fun. And anyway, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about this book. was trying to think about how this began, and I realized that my books don't really begin with stories. They tend to begin with a character. And of the now 6 books that I've written and published, I have one book I wrote that's really terrible that I didn't publish. My dad liked it. I can actually remember exactly the place that I was, where I was when the first little tiny seed of an idea struck me that then grew into a book. And with the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, it was Carmen, actually. I was sitting in an opera, and it was a really boring opera, and my mind was wandering off, and I had this idea of this young woman. I felt like she was Hispanic. I wasn't sure totally why. And I felt that she was the only daughter of a single mother. And they had that incredible kind of mother-daughter, only child, single mother bond. And then I thought about this sort of lost father of hers and all the ideas that she had about him. And that somehow was it. And then Carmen grew out of that. Lena was born shortly thereafter. Then Tibby. Bridget came along last. The idea of the friendship, the feeling of the friendship, then the pants, and the role that the pants would play in their lives. It all kind of came from that. So with this book, with Three Willows, I remember I was walking on the beach, and I was actually thinking a little bit of Barack Obama, oddly enough. I mean, not that he's a grand person to think about these days particularly. But I was somehow thinking about what it is to be a child of an immigrant and how sometimes there's a natural kind of role reversal that happens there because, you know, the child is almost sort of more at home than the parents. They're born in the country and the parents aren't. They have their peer group. They have the language. And that sometimes there's some interesting reversals that happen. And somehow out of that idea came this character whose name is Ama. And her family emigrated from Ghana. She has a sister who's an absolute superstar of a student, very, very precocious. She goes to Princeton when she's 16. They're a very studious family, and Ama wants desperately to be like her sister. And then I guess I thought about Joe. She was the next character I was thinking about. And I thought about... divorce is a theme that I tend to like to explore in my books. I think partly because my own parents got divorced, and I tend not to write very autobiographically about it, but the themes are always interesting and compelling to me, so I seem like I go back to them. So in this case, it's a girl who's, it's Joe. I knew her parents, that their marriage was falling apart, that there were some really hard things in their past, and that she was being utterly determined to not think about that, and instead she focuses all her energy on this social situation at this beach town restaurant she's working at. And she's thinking about, you know, she's a bus girl, but she's sort of jealous of the waitresses because they're older and they're cool. And she has this kind of fling with this older guy and then discovers that he has a girlfriend already, but somehow can't quite make her stop. So, and then came Polly. And she was actually born of something I was reading. I was reading about, something in the New Yorker, I think it was a story, I can't remember exactly. I got to a certain sentence and then I stopped, and it had something to do with a character who lived in this fantasy world of movie stars and supermodels. And that somehow or other, she was not very happy in her own body, in her own life, in the circumstances of her own life, and probably didn't have a lot of friends, and somehow or other just transported herself into all these other lives and took them very, very seriously. And that somehow was how this character, Polly, got started. So I thought this was a friendship that was developing for me, and I thought, well, this is a subject that I like. I like to write about friends. I like to write about girls and their families. And at first I thought, well, I'm not sure how this relates to what I've done before. And I was sort of trying to avoid it a little bit. And eventually I felt like I was trying too hard not to do and not to write about what I'd written about before. And these characters are new, so they have their own lives and they're quite distinct from any other character I've written. But then I kind of thought, I've always loved the idea of fictional worlds all being somehow unified. The idea that every book I write, even if it's not you know, a four-book series like The Sisterhood was, that somehow every book I would write that, you know, I wrote a book called The Last Summer of You and Me, it's kind of a love story, that somewhere those characters exist in the same world as these other characters, and that somehow maybe every novel that, you know, I love like Thomas Hardy, where he creates this fictional county in England, and all the books are set there, and there's all these little crosses and bits and pieces that you find from one book to the next. So I thought, maybe I'll go back to the same place, maybe I'll set this in the same world and in the same time frame. And then I thought, why not just give these characters the same things I'm thinking about? What is the relevance of this older sisterhood? How does it affect how they're thinking about friendship? And so these are girls that they actually know. They went to the same high school. They have sort of a reputation, a little bit of a legacy at that high school. And these girls know about them. And, you know, Bridget was Joe's coach at soccer camp briefly. And Polly babysits for Tibby's younger brother and sister. So I started to think about letting this just sort of relax into that old world, and let and allow, you know, those characters to exist in the background, even in these girls' minds, that they think about them and think, you know, why isn't our sisterhood like that? Why isn't our friendship like that? And one of the things I think I was interested in as a writer is I depended, and my characters depended, in the sisterhood books, a whole lot on good luck. There's the circumstances of their mothers, who basically introduced them when they were in utero. They were sort of raised as babies together. They had each other always, like sisters. And at the moment when they're first separating, the pants come along. And the pants are kind of mixed luck when you stop and think about it. But in general, there's a great reliance on luck and on circumstance. And it's funny because I feel like as a writer, in my own experience, I had just a tremendous amount of luck with those books. I mean, I was a first-time writer. It was my first book. My expectations for it were very, very small. I had been warned that, you know, this part of the book market for teenagers was incredibly slow. And, you know, I shouldn't quit my day job. And you know, amazingly enough, it worked out well, and it sold a lot, and eventually I was able to quit my day job, and two movies came out of it, which were a great deal of fun for me. So I felt like, you know, I wanted to separate myself from the luck and relying on pants and relying on that kind of friendship that's just ready-made. So I felt like I'd give these characters that same challenge of trying to do this without the same benefit of luck. So I give them a little bit of a harder time. It's a harder friendship, and it's one that ultimately they it seems like it's falling apart. And the fact that they're entering high school, the fact that Jo has these ideas of her new image and wanting to grow up much faster, and it makes it a lot harder. Just the regular cycles of life, it makes it a lot harder for these girls to stay friends. And so so they spend a summer. I seem to like to write books about summers. And over the course of the summer, you know, there's some real challenges, and they have to sort of earn their way, find their way back, in each in her own way, to this friendship. It was funny because I thought, you know, when I was originally talking about this book and even talking to my editors about it, I could see they were sort of saying, well, what's going to be the pants in this book, you know? And I kind of felt like, well, you know, that's sort of the point. There really aren't any pants in this book. I mean, literally there aren't any pants, but, you know, I don't want to substitute another metaphor for the sake of it. And these girls even joke about that. They joke about trying to have a scarf and a skirt and a jacket, and they just feel stupid after a while. You know, they don't want to try and replicate something that doesn't feel like it's authentically theirs. So I sort of said, you know, I don't want to have that kind of controlling metaphor in this book. I just want to do it a little bit differently. And so it was funny because I felt like from the beginning of writing this book, I had a feeling of, you know, I gave them these little saplings the first day of third grade when these three girls meet. And as I drew their stories along, I realized that as they get further and further away from themselves in some way, from their younger selves and from this friendship, part of what starts to bring them back is kind of a relationship to nature, to the natural world. In the case of Amma, she's so indoors, she's so studious, she's so focused on that and that alone. And then she's sort of forced to this to go on this outdoor trip, and she hates it. But eventually, as she kind of gets a little bit more peace with it, she starts to remember Ghana, where she was born and where she grew up, and where her memories are sort of vague. But she remembers the birds, and she remembers this mango tree outside her house, and it sort of starts to wake her up to something that's deeper in her and that's meaningful from the very beginning of her life. And for Jo too, since she's had these family tragedies, it's almost like her mother has kind of sealed their house, and you know, none of the outside air gets in, and everything is controlled and everything is clean. And she gets to a point where she just sort of has to open the windows and has to let the air in, and has to just sort of, you know, let the weeds grow in the garden. And and Polly too has her own relationship to this. So by the very end, I was sort of having this notion of the metaphor of the willow tree, and these girls sort of realize, having searched for a metaphor when they were much younger, that in fact they sort of had one all along, and it came as a bit of an epiphany to them, and I realized it sort of did for me too. But in a way, I think, you know, the willow trees are something. I've always loved the willow, and one of the sort of the character of the tree that I love is that you know, no matter how far you cut it back, that it'll always grow. And even if you cut it back so it's just sort of a dried piece of wood, so they say, and I haven't tried this, although I would like to someday, it still has the spark of life, and if you plant it, it will grow again. So the sort of the resiliency of these girls and who they really, really are, that ended up being not pants by any stretch, but something that proved very valuable to me as I was writing the book. So I'm going to read to you a little bit about, I was telling you about Jo and her social ambitions at this restaurant in this beach town. I'm trying to think if you need to know anything else. The boy who she has a crush on, his name is Zach. He's a waiter at the restaurant. And for some reason, he's very flirtatious, and he calls her Goldie. "Do you guys have plans for tonight?" Jo asked Megan as she brought an armful of menus back to the hostess station. Megan looked tentative as she stacked the menus on the shelf. "It's waitress's night out," she explained apologetically. "Effie organized it." I stop myself for a moment. This is one of the overlaps for any of you who've read the Traveling Pants books. Our dear Effie has come back. This is Lena's younger sister. "Well, my mom is away tonight. My house is totally empty. You guys should come over." Jo was surprised at how quickly and eagerly she played this trump card. Megan looked sorry. "I don't know, Jo. I think Effie had something else in mind." "We've got lots of chips and stuff. My mom and I went to Costco over the weekend. We could invite the boys, too. And I shouldn't really say this, but..." Jo dropped her voice. "The liquor cabinet is full." The part of Jo's brain that wasn't talking was wondering why in the world she was saying the things she was saying. Her mom would find out if she had a bunch of people over and raided the liquor cabinet. She had never done anything like that before, and she would get in huge trouble. Why was she offering it? "Jo," Megan looked pained. "Maybe another time, okay? Effie said no bussers. I didn't make the plans. I've hung out with you guys tons of times this summer. Can't you tell Effie that?" Megan made a face, and Jo wasn't sure she wanted to try to interpret it. It had to do with Zach, she knew. Zach was in large part the secret of Joe's social success this summer up until now. And now that Effie was back and claiming him, Jo had become controversial. No one seemed to want to look at her or talk to her today. She was to be avoided, and Zach was avoiding her too. Why were they all willing to side with Effie right away? Jo was the one who'd been around all summer. Didn't they all know that she and Zach had kissed many times? That it was more than just a flirtation? She had as much of a claim on him as Effie did, if not more. It was almost like everyone was scared of Effie. But Jo wasn't going to go along with that. She was not scared of Effie, let Effie be scared of her. The last table cleared out by 10, seeming to know how little Joe wanted to go home alone. She watched the waitresses leave, all dressed up and made up. Overnight, Effie had become their ringleader, and apparently she was more hierarchical than the rest of them. At last, Joe set out for home. "Hey, Goldie." Zach surprised Joe on the boardwalk. Her heart surged at the sight of him. She couldn't help herself. "Hi," she said. "What's up?" "I'm supposed to be mad at you," she told him in her mind. "You're a skank." So why was she so happy to see him? "I'm just heading home," she said. He checked the time on his cell phone. "You've got 25 minutes until your curfew." She was flattered that he still knew it. "It's only been a few days. Why wouldn't he know it?" she scolded herself. "Can I walk you home on the beach?" he asked her. "Don't you have a girlfriend?" she said. She meant it to sound pointed and mischievous, but it just sounded like a regular question. He started walking anyway, and she went along behind him. "We're just walking, right?" she added, quickening her step to catch his. "You make it sound like I'm married or something, Joe," Zach said, grabbing her hand and swinging it. "Trust me, I'm not." "That shouldn't be good enough," said a voice in her head that sounded a lot like Amma. "You shouldn't trust him about anything. He doesn't deserve you," a voice that sounded like Polly piped up. But Joe didn't take her hand back from him. On the first night, Zach had told her she had strong hands. She still wanted to believe in him. "Believing in him shouldn't take this much effort," the voice of Amma told her. "Shut up, you guys," she said to the Amma and Polly in her head. Instead of leading her down to the water, as Zach usually did, he led her up toward the lights of the boardwalk. She was surprised that he wanted to go back up, but it turned out he didn't. He led her underneath to where it was dark and slightly drippy. Even the quality of the sand was different under here. "Hey, Goldie." "Yeah?" "I think about you all day long." "When you aren't making out with Effie." That was what Joe should have said, but she didn't. She craved his attention so much, it scared her a little. His eyes were on her and only her now. And she didn't want to challenge him or ruin it. When he grabbed her free hand and held both of them, she let him. He was so dazzling to look at. He had a regular flush in his cheeks under his tan, giving his face more innocence than he deserved. He had a reckless and joyful expression that he wore nearly all the time. His posture was loose and his confidence was intoxicating. She thought of ways to deflect his kiss, but she mostly hoped it would come. She would take what he offered. She couldn't help it. She wanted to be here and now and nowhere else. She didn't want to have to think. Zach leaned in and kissed her. She made no effort to fend him off. He put his arms around her, pushing her against him. She kissed him back. She stopped thinking altogether. She felt his warm palms on her back. Her heart was pounding. "Don't make me think," she told him in her mind. "Don't make me talk. I don't know how to say no right now." But it wasn't Zach or his creeping hands that made her have to think. It was the sound of a shout and of powdery footsteps on the sand nearby. She looked up, forced from her dream in jarring fashion. There was one girl nearby, looking at them, and three more girls farther away. Zach let go of Joe and pulled away. Joe recognized the face. It was Violet, another one of the waitresses. Violet got close enough to let them see it was her, and then scampered back to the group. Effie was there. Joe could see that clearly now. Megan and Sheba, too. All the girls were looking at Joe and Zach, now standing several feet apart. Joe felt a cold, flat drip on the top of her head, and it seemed to wake her up. What was she thinking? The two of them under the boardwalk? How tacky could you get? Joe knew instinctively and ominously that for a girl like Effie, it was much worse discovering Joe and Zach together at the same moment as her friends. There was no way for Effie to spin it or dodge it or gain some feeling of power over it. There was no way for her to save face, to make them all believe that Zach really did love her the best. If Joe had doubted Zach when he said Effie wasn't his girlfriend, she doubted him even more now. All the joy and the mischief were gone from his face. "I'm going to go," Joe said quietly to Zach. under the gaze of many eyes, she pulled herself together and walked home. She felt empty. She felt like she'd been scrounging crumbs off a dirty floor, wanting to believe she was getting a full meal. She felt like she hadn't truly eaten in many days. She wished she could make her sadness go backward, or even forward, to look back on it, or postpone it. But it was here and now. How depressing of her to debase herself like that. How sad of her to try to find happiness in so little. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fota, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Muhammad Yunus, David and Nick Sheff, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on January 22nd, 2009.